This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han, and that was Marvin Gaye. Can I get a witness? Brilliant, brilliant work. Yeah. I love Marvin Gaye. I don't know about you,
Han. And what a fabulous way to kick off the morning run for this week, though. How about that?
Yeah, okay. Now, of course, you know, as journalists, we pay witness to what's happening in the world over the weekend, and still raging, a range of things, including wildfires across Europe. We also had that win by Roger Federer, 8-time Wimbledon, and I think the oldest man to achieve that victory. Also in Venezuela, a vote, a referendum called by civil society and opposition figures that the government doesn't acknowledge is real, but it's expected to draw millions of Venezuelans fed up with what they consider mismanagement of their government and economy.
Yeah, and if I can go back to that Roger Federer win there, I mean, that's just phenomenal. I mean, I am a sports fan. So, you know, given that 35-year-old Federer apparently won this Wimbledon, and according to some media reports, he did so without dropping a single set all tournament long. So, you know, in this final game, you know, he won it in 3 sets against Marin Cilic. So, yeah, pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, and Cilic was, because, hobbled by a blister that left him, I think, at one point breaking down and crying, I think, in the middle of the match. So, quite a bit of drama there out in Wimbledon. Also, somewhat dramatic, perhaps in a field less known for as a spectator sport, math genius, the Iranian-born Mariam Mirzakhani, who was the first woman to win the coveted Fields Medal. This is an award given to mathematicians every couple of years. Died at the age of 40 after a battle with cancer. And it's kind of extraordinary because I think people who make great achievements in certain fields don't get recognized because that field seems so arcane, so sort of, you know, about just specialists. So I think her work was in geometry or something. I don't even know how to explain it. It's math, quite sad. The thing, though, you know, with this particular person is that I think there's always this threat of the story of achievements being overshadowed by some of the cultural politics around her. So I think the Iranian government, though, I think everybody from the president down has, issued commiserations. There was all this question of whether she could be depicted without wearing her headscarf. And in later years, she did not wear a headscarf because she lived in the U.S. as well. So all this is kind of like the cultural politics around Iranian society, the role of women, and et cetera. So all that fascinating stuff, if you care to be a spectator sport of math and the world of math as opposed to sports.
Yeah, like, okay. Pure sports. Yeah. I mean, geometry, again, which field? I mean, so this, she had specialized in geometry, is that what you said?
Yeah, so okay. Her work, and I'm trying to look at, we can tweet out the link to the story. It's covered by many media because she was kind of very well known, at least in her field. But I wouldn't be able to explain what she went on. I mean, so many prizes. If you look at her list, and anyway, she taught in Princeton and then in Stanford, where she was when she died. We're coming up to a quick break now. Bryan Adams, Summer of 69, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that's Bryan Adams, Summer of 69, Tan Chung Han, myself, Sharad Kutin. We're back because also over the weekend we had news that of a discovery of what is considered a raft of plastic debris spanning some 2.5 million square kilometers.
Wow.
It's been found concentrated in the region of the South Pacific. That extraordinary discussions we're having now about what we're doing to the planet, because we had last week that ice shelf in the Antarctic breaking off to create one of the biggest, known in history, iceberg, the Larsen Sea. I think that was one it is. And of course, along with it, you know, just general discussions of climate change and what it's doing to the planet. And then, of course, now this discovery of plastics. No surprise, you know, all through the 80s, now in the 70s, we talked about pesticides being found in animals in the Antarctic. Once, you know, we pour, that's kind of really underscoring the fact that we're so interconnected, the planet, you know. So you pour poisons in one part of the planet, they turn up in animals far, far away in another side of the planet. Just all of which, because leads some people to ask, is it responsible to have kids in this era?
Wow, that's a loaded question right there for
Isn't
you.
It?
Monday morning, yeah.
I don't know. Are you going to have kids? Does anybody want to have kids with you?
I don't know. Which is another loaded question, yeah. So, like, way to get personal on this Monday morning here. I understand the emotional argument here, but I wonder, you know, if people who are actually, you know, planning to have kids, whether or not they take these into account, though, you know, do they actually consider or like the greater good or where the world is headed, or and are we on this sustainable path, you know, before actually having those kids, as opposed to just having kids because it's their personal choice they want to, you know, and it means a certain need or desire in their life, right? So, yeah, I wonder if that I'm trying to find out, you know, how much this the environmental concerns actually weighs on an individual's decision to have kids.
I'm guessing not very much, and I think, in fact, in many ways, our personal choices are quite blinkered when it comes to the larger question of where the planet's going. And I don't know if having a kid is necessarily detrimental to the planet, or if having a kid is responsible to the kid, being that you're now condemning them to a life where the planet is going to, as they grow up, is going to really fall apart, heat up, or become quite a horrible place to live in. So, you know, I think there's all those questions. Most of us are motivated in terms of our personal habits, whether it's something big like having a child, or, you know, it's something like buying a car, you know, it's really directed at the present, the immediate. I don't think many of us have the capacity to think, well, 50 years from now, when my child is in their late 60s, this planet will be boiling, you know, coming to a boil.
Right, but nevertheless, it is these individual decisions that are contributing to climate change and whatnot, right? You know, it is that decision to buy the car. It is that decision to use that plastic bag that resulted in that, 2.5 million, square kilometer?
Yeah. It's a plastic raft that's floating.
Plastic raft. I mean, how about that? That's an island. That's not a raft, but that's 2.5
that's
million.
That's a continent.
Yeah.
But, you know, the question is then, you know, I mean, still, I mean, in some ways, these questions are posed at a level that perhaps, as you rightly point out, isn't going to be there when people make decisions about, very personal decisions about their lives. But we should be asking these questions, don't you think?
Yeah, no, certainly. But again, given that many of our decisions are filtered through that individualistic lens, right? It's, you know, how does it benefit me, right? And so many of our decisions are based on that very simplified narrative. So I wonder if, you know, we really should start asking, well, if I buy that plastic bag, or if I use that plastic bag, or if I buy that car, or if I consume this particular product, or even if I decide to have a kid. I'm not saying that having a kid is the same as using a plastic bag, you know, two different things there. But again, whether or not we can start broadening that kind of pushing back that horizon to perhaps consider the long-term consequences of our decisions.
Have you watched the Kingsman, the Secret Service series of movies? Yeah, you remember one of the series dealt precisely with the question of what would be good for the planet, and the evil genius came up with the very simple solution: get people to kill each other in large enough numbers, and that the planet will be much better off with half, maybe a tenth of the people, or nine-tenths of the people gone. I think that was the solution. It was a brilliant, I think the premise of that was brilliant. So if you have never watched The Kingsman, the Secret Service series, check that one out.
Or not have kids? Yeah. And that's a question
mark.
That's
the one with Samuel Jackson in it as a megalomaniac. Brilliant stuff. I thought was so funny. Okay, now we have The Velvet Underground, Who Loves the Sun? After these ads, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that's The Velvet Underground with Who Loves the Sun? You and I do, Han, don't we?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Tan Chung Han, Sharad Kutin, we're both sun lovers. Of course, we can get too much of it, and especially if we deplete the ozone layer, then it's really going to be a little too much. We might not love the sun.
We've got a bit of
much.
A morbid undertone
it's a sign of the times, dude. You know, breathe the zeitgeist, okay? Now, of course, even as there's a battle royale in the U.S. over net neutrality with some of the biggest internet firms, the Googles, the Reddits of the world, fighting it out with the cable network, the internet service providers of the U.S. Over the question of the regulatory framework for the net and the principle of net neutrality. We have smaller discussions about what goes on in our very private lives with regard to our relationship to the internet and all the different platforms that are available. And one of them, of course, is Twitter. I'm on Twitter, and I'm quite a kind of avid user of Twitter. Mm-hmm. Han, I know you're on Twitter, but not so.
Nope. So I guess one of the reasons why we're discussing this is because you have Christy Alsop, I believe that's her name, and she's a presenter with Channel 4's Location, 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 which is based out of UK. And so apparently one of her tweets had sparked a fierce firestorm, and an online firestorm, so to speak. And apparently that has prompted her to quit Twitter altogether. Now, I'll tell you this right now, that thought is not alien to me. I have considered it many, many times.
Is it because you've been the subject of so much?
No.
Public rancor, and there's been a debate, and your name's been bandied about,
no.
And people have
no. I just don't have time for it.
Yes, okay. So I think this is very interesting because you might actually if you know that series of the television that deals with furniture and upscaling, and I think that's who she is, Christy Alsop.
Location.
Yeah, so that's I think one of the new series, but the old series you might remember from that. The point of it is that so she's an avid user. She promotes her charities on it, but she also weighs in on just things about design and homes, and the immediate kerfuffle surrounded her opinion about washing machines located in kitchens. And she said, I think that's disgusting, mixing clothes with food preparation, never a good idea. And then there's all this pushback, mm-hmm. right? And so she says, and her reason for leaving Twitter is that Brits, and she's referring to British people, have lost their sense of humor. Mm. But you might actually say that she herself can't take the criticism. So she's kind of dishing it out with words like disgusting for having, washing machine in your kitchen. And then when there's quite a bit of pushback on it, she feels, people don't have a sense of humor and I'm quitting. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a huge amount of sensitivity. I don't know why people take discussions they have on social media so seriously.
Well, if you're going to refer to Godwin's Law, now it's an actual entry into the Oxford English Dictionary, and you can check it out, Godwin's Law. Essentially, and it says this, as an online discussion grows longer, the probability of a comparison involving Hitler approaches. Now, so often we see, I mean, if you just go through the thread of any online argument right there, and you can see the lack of rational thought, or the lack of rationality that is evident in these comment threads.
And the very quick spiraling down into, bitter rancor over issues that perhaps don't deserve it, right?
Right.
I mean, and washing machines and kitchens.
And it's not just even the issues, but perhaps people, who perhaps in the past didn't have this elevated platform of showcasing their thoughts, however dark or warped these thoughts might be. All of a sudden, you got personalities in the social media space who are forced to contend with some ideas that are just out there, right? Which even beggars common sense, right?
I must admit, I mean, there were times, and when I was very much into this kind of online discussions, and I too had, I think, a very kind of blinkered view of things in this very kind of almost literal sense. You're constantly looking down at the screen or holding the screen up, and that becomes your world. And so discussions within it take on the kind of importance that they wouldn't if you just looked up and recognized that you're working off a tiny little device, in this vast world. I mean, just your city, never mind the universe. And so what would actually put it in perspective, but because you're kind of like you're zooming in on this, and I think the passions are a function of how much, how obsessive people are rather than the actual objective value of that debate.
And also given the fact that you can only have these arguments in 140 characters or less, and also, I mean, coupled with the notion that tone very often gets lost via social media anyway, so it just does not make for a conducive platform for any healthy debate, right? I mean, at least that's my base case scenario here.
Yeah, but you see, for me, it's like, okay, if you have the right attitude there and you put social media in its place,
that's
it's a huge
caveat, though. It's like, you know, to assume that, you know, Facebook's 2 billion users all have the right attitude 24/7 or every time they're logged on, that's a big ass. So
I'm asking this of just the individuals that I interact with, right? That we all keep things in perspective. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we've created a monster, and, you know, and that monster, you know, is actually, you know, cast in our own likeness. I mean, the media and these platforms are really a function of us. They're not making us.
Speak for yourself there, buddy.
they are exacerbating things. So I think it's endlessly fascinating to watch these things. But I must say, I think the bigger issue is not the battle of Twitter about kitchens, about washing machines and kitchens. It's really net neutrality. And that's something we should all be kind of looking out for.
My personal stance is, if the boss gives me the go-ahead to not be on Twitter, I'm good to go. I'll take that off right now.
Okay. The Counting Crows, Accidentally in Love, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Arcade Fire there with a Ready to Start, Tan Chung Han, Sharad Kutin. We're both ready to start. The morning run is well on its way. It's 40 minutes past 6 in the morning. It's the 17th of July, the day when the MRT system entire line goes into full operation. We had a soft launch of part of the line. And of course, you know, if you've taken it, Hannah, as I have, you'll notice very few people on it, except maybe kids with their parents thinking they're going for a joyride, and which is not justified by the cost of the line itself, right? So, but now we get the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It probably makes sense for people to use it because it really does go right across the valley in ways that are very useful, opening up spaces to entire suburbs, you know, between suburbs and such.
Yeah, so today will mark the launch of the new Sungai Buloh to Kajang line. It's been called a game changer. You know, some numbers that have been thrown about is that this line could take some 160,000 cars off the road.
The question, of course, is that sufficient? Mm. And, you know, did we pay too much money for it? And we have the perennial problem of first mile, last mile connectivity that, you know, really has plagued, it will plague any transport system.
You know, but some of the fares here are pretty, I mean, pretty conducive here, you know, because the lowest fare starts at, or the fares start at 1 ringgit, with the most expensive fare for that line will go up to 6 ringgit 40 cent, presumably one way. And so I think that's pretty good.
Well, the fares, I think, are not a problem. The issue is
the cost, right?
Yeah. No, the issue is if you can't, if it takes an interminable amount of time for you to get to the station from your home, and if it's unpredictable, as it is with the LRT, the feeder services, at least in my neighborhood, coming from Asia Jaya, and I hope somebody from the relevant authorities are listening to this because I've complained enough times, it just completely makes no sense, you know, because you don't know when the buses are coming. You wait a very, very long time. And how do you plan your day, especially, you know, commute to work or back home, if the bus service, which connects you between the stations and your home, isn't working in an efficient manner?
Oh, no, certainly. And there's plenty of room for the discussion of the efficiency, you know, of this rollout of this broader master transportation plan. But nevertheless, there is a need. There are many people who use it. And now that the entire line has been opened up for the Sungai Buloh Kajang line, you know, hopefully that the idea is to then be able to serve, you know, many of these people who can, you know, use this kind of services.
Yeah, on a rhetorical level, nobody says that. You know, I'm all for public transport. But the hard questions about the failures of last mile connectivity that plagues the LRT system, you know, will it revisit the MRT system that wasn't fixed there? Mm. What makes you think it's going to be fixed on this? And, you know, and all that comes with it. And the thing is, great intentions, huge amount of money put into hoopla and, you know, media spin and such. You know, I remember when the first bit of the line was put out, it was like, oh, we were striding into the first world, da, da, da. But, you know, that kind of thing doesn't help you recognize that this is just a very, we're talking about practical solutions to practical problems.
And part of the practical solutions would then, you know, this could be a catalyst for the likes of Uber and Grab and, heck, even taxis, right? In solving that first mile, last mile conundrum.
And then the costs could go up, because what you want is, on a daily basis, not to be taking taxis, but be taking buses. I mean, so the thing is, I was in a Grab the other day or Uber, I can't remember which one it was, but the guy said to me, it's amazing what Singapore does. You know, if you go to a bus stop in Singapore, it tells you what time the bus is arriving and leaving. Mm-hmm. Asia Jaya LRT, they just tell you what time the bus is arriving, meaning the bus comes and parks itself in the depot. It doesn't give you the more crucial information which you need to make a decision about whether you take a taxi or wait for the bus, which is when the bus is leaving. It's an extraordinary amount of technology and electronics spent to provide you zero practical information.
Look. Given that, you know, this line is open today, I would like to think, you know, that this is a step in the right direction. Again, execution risk and, you know, efficiencies. I mean, if you're going to compare the infrastructure of Singapore versus Malaysia, I mean, come on now. You know, let's compare apples with apples, right? It's a lot easier to manage the infrastructure for a small city island state as opposed to, you know, the sprawling mass that is the Klang Valley, right? And also given all the competing interests as well.
What is it about our system that you cannot provide the right information? Meaning, there's a board. If you go to the LRT station, Asia Jaya, there's a board that tells you what time the bus is coming, not what time the bus is leaving. You don't have to be a Singapore to work that one out.
No, sure. To be fair, there are some bus stops that actually have those kind of indicators as well, timing indicators as well. But nevertheless, you know, before we throw this wet blanket over, you know, before this thing is even launched, I believe at 4 p.m. today, I like to think that this is a massive step in the right direction in attempts to alleviate the traffic woes here in the Klang Valley. And maybe not at 6:45 a.m.
And definitely somebody made a lot of money from all this. Okay, Curtis Mayfield, Superfly, after these ads, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm sure I couldn't really turn Chung Han. Very quickly, the Malaysian online retail market is expected to grow by 23% per year through to the year 2021. And with it, the number of fraudulent online transactions have also increased. We spoke to Shabana Nasir Ahmad. She is a senior manager at the Department of Legal Policy at the National Consumers Complaint Center, and asked her how many complaints the NCCC has seen with regard to online shopping.
For the past 3 years, I think online shopping has been our number one complaint. And it is not just in Malaysia. Globally, I think we are moving towards technology and how people are depending on online shopping. In 2013 alone, the total complaints that we have received in NCCC is 5,763, with a potential loss amounting to 1 million. So in 2014 and 2015, we have seen an increase. I think it's quite a big jump from 5,000 to 7,641, followed by in 2015, it's about 7,692 complaints.
That was Shabana Nasir Ahmad, Senior Manager at the Department of Legal Policy at the National Consumers Complaint Centre. Han, we also then went to Hans-Peter Russell, CEO of Lazada Malaysia, to ask him how does Lazada Malaysia deal with the question of the integrity of that sales process?
Yes, we actually have a very strict process here for sellers that want to sell on our platform. First, they go through an onboarding process in which they either physically or digitally through webinars need to participate in an onboarding and training process where we show them what are they allowed to do, what are they not allowed to do, what are the prohibited products. After that, I mean, as a big marketplace platform where we have tens of thousands of sellers online with more than 35 million products, we need to have a strong QC team, audit team that actually checks the platform, audits the platform, goes through the subcategories that are relevant and could compromise the customer experience. So we have an audit and QC team here that vets through all the things that might create potentially bad customer experience. And then on top of that, we have an automated process enabled by, you know, our technology that allows us to search for certain keywords and search for certain products and flag them in our system, and that would trigger a manual audit on top.
That was Hans-Peter Ressel, CEO of Lazada Malaysia. Han, do you ever concern you when you get online and you buy things online? Are you ever so cautious?
Oh, yeah, no, certainly. And that is a trade-off that you have to partake in, right? If you want that convenience of online shopping and having to give up, you know, your identity or that part of your identity and also your personal particulars when it comes to making that digital payment, you offset that by the risk of, you know, perhaps being exposed with these counterfeit goods or these dodgy digital transactions, right? It's comforting to know that Lazada has these kind of processes in place, these safeguards. But one has to question really how far it goes. And hopefully they can leverage on Alibaba's experience in that matter because, you know, you recall, I think just a few weeks ago, we spoke about how Alibaba is set to invest an additional $1 billion into Lazada. And, you know, recently Jack Ma had spoken about how counterfeit goods is the cancer of Alibaba. You know, so it's not something that's unique to the Malaysian context. You know, obviously, every time you join in the you delve into the online space and try to make any digital purchases, you know, that's the risk that you're going to take, though.
Okay. Kind of an aside, if you ever go to Bangkok and are looking for kind of like things to do in Bangkok, and I know that there's a huge number of things to do in Bangkok, check out the Counterfeit Museum. Ah. There's a museum of counterfeit goods. It's fascinating. Okay, back to the question of fraud. I mean, I must admit, personally, I used to have a real kind of psychological hump to get over in terms of giving, say, my credit card details online. I just could not do it. I just thought that it's not safe. Somebody's going to spend a lot of money because I've been a victim of credit card fraud in the past. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, I've really gotten over that hump. And today, perhaps, I'm far too comfortable giving personal information, purchasing things and expecting, you know, that nothing will go wrong. You know, it used to be, when I used to purchase airline tickets, you know, and because I come from a generation that were, you know, would go to a travel agent.
Yeah.
I've forgotten what they're called now.
And they print out the actual ticket.
Thinking you'd have that, then the counter foils.
Yeah,
and there was so many,
I remember that.
All that's disappeared. You just, you know, sometimes the printout that you provide, the people, the counters, even, you know, they look at it for about 2 seconds and they give it back to you because all they really need is your ID, and then everything kind of falls into place.
Well, right? I still have some of those concerns, though, because, like, let's say I buy an airline ticket or I book a hotel online, I'm constantly grabbing, like, doing a screen grab, and, you know, make sure I email it to myself, or maybe even print some hard copies, you know. But it'd be interesting to find out the nature of the complaints, what the 7,692 complaints that the NCCC has, that have been lodged with the NCCC over the last couple of years or so. So whether or not it's actually just, fraudulent, I mean, is it fraud or is it identity theft or is it just shady goods? I wonder what it is.
When you buy something off a platform and they advertise the specs of the goods, I mean, I can see where it could go wrong. First of all, they don't send you the thing. Two, they send you the thing, but it's not quite the thing you thought you were buying and all that was advertised. I mean, there's a whole range of possibilities when it comes to that online thing because you don't actually see it. And I've learned the hard way not to buy, say, fresh produce online. Oh. No, you can do it because you do supermarket shopping, right? The thing that you really want to do is the stuff that is really
non-perishable.
Yeah, and also that you don't have to look at. You know, sometimes when you want to buy, say, you know, chicken, you know, and you really want to have a look at the quality of the skin of the chicken and the flesh and the meat and such.
Like, as opposed to like a can of Milo or something where you don't really need to look at it, just order it. Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, but, you know, still, I recall a recent experience when I bought one of my cars, and the down payment that I did, for some reason, I decided to use a credit card, and it actually double charged me, though. So imagine being double charged for a down payment of a car. You know, go figure. And this was on the eve of Chinese New Year a few years back.
How do they do that? Yeah, how do they manage a double charge?
Exactly, right? So it got stuck, and, like, you know, and well, they told me that it didn't go through. So then it went through, and they did another transaction. And so it was a double transaction. And this was on the eve of Chinese New Year. You know, so all that disposable income for my Chinese New Year shenanigans, that was all locked up because of this digital, this mishap. But to be fair, they resolved it. But nevertheless, just highlighting once again the risks that are associated with digital payments.
Okay, we're coming up to the top of the hour. We're going to have the news. Remember the launch of Phase 2 of the Sungai Buloh Kajang Line, something you might want to go a bit of a joyride just to check it out, I guess. But the more important thing is whether you use it for your daily commute. And we get all that. There's wonderful payoffs in terms of the dividends of public transport. We'll be back with more analysis after that. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Shoa Kutin with Nithan Chung Han. Time to look at some of the stories that are shaping our planet Malaysia. Last week, Pakatan Harapan, the Federal Opposition Front, announced its presidential council lineup with Dr. Mahathir from Bersatu as chairman, Dr. Wan Azizah from PKR as president, and Dato Sri Anwar Ibrahim as its Ketua Umum, translated by some media as de facto leader. I'm still wondering how best to translate that. On Friday, Umapagan Ambike Parkin spoke to Ben Sofian from Merdeka Centre to get his thoughts on the lineup.
Yeah, the lineup is very interesting, and the titles given to individuals, I think, represents the various face-saving measures needed in order to assuage the key players so that they all have the chief title appended to their name.
And also it means that someone from every party gets to play a role. I mean, Dr. Mahathir is from the youngest party and yet he is the chairman. Anwar Ibrahim can't really hold any official position given that he's in prison, so he's the de facto leader. And then, of course, Wan Azizah kind of carries on her position from the former Pakatan coalition of being president.
Yeah, certainly. I think the lineup represents the efforts between the pre-existing Pakatan and Dr. Mahathir's party to have a lineup of leaders that, you know, like you said, meet the expectations of the parties. But I think beyond the actual lineup, I think looking at what's really going to be the story here moving forward is that given that Dr. Mahathir is the chairperson and how he typically conducts meetings, both present and in the past, it is very clear that he is going to be the head of the locomotive that's going to pull everybody along in the same direction, whether they like it or not. And it also represents a victory of sorts for Dr. Mahathir because, you know, he comes from the youngest party with only one parliamentary seat, with no seats to call its own. He is given, I would say, a premier position to lead the coalition. It also speaks of the lack of leadership talent at that national level among the rest of the opposition parties, such that they need to work with their former nemesis to lead them into facing Barisan Nasional.
So Ben, tell me this, given history and how Dr. Mahathir operates and also how dysfunctional the opposition has been, in your opinion, is Dr. Mahathir the key, that silver bullet that's required to somehow rein people in? I want to say, is he the dictator that the opposition requires to keep them all in line?
Well, if we read the statement in full, and given how Dr. Mahathir has signed his name to the whole list of reforms, I think we can now downgrade him from dictator to the stern schoolmaster who is going to corral his unruly school kids into a fighting force to challenge the Barisan Nasional.
One final thing, they've actually also finally revealed their logo. I mean, they had an initial concept that was met with a lot of criticism from the public. And a couple of months later now, they've got a logo. It's the word Harapan in white on a red background with a central A that's kind of shaped like a chevron, right?
Yes. Well, I think it, you know, there is a subliminal message there. If you look at the whole logo, you know, the prominence of the chevron in the middle, you know, I think rises far beyond the wording that goes to the left and right of it.
Correct.
So critics will say that it represents an appendage of some of the leaders. But I think it talks about the future going forward into space, the final frontier, going where no Malaysian has gone before.
It does look very much like the Star Trek logo.
Certainly.
That was Umapagan Ambike Pagan speaking to Ben Sofian of Merdeka Centre with that rather cheeky note about the central image in the Pakatan Harapan kind of joint coalition logo.
Yeah.
And speaking about the central image, though, one glaring omission remains that who will be the Prime Minister candidate from the Pakatan Harapan. Now, they have mentioned the eighth one, you know, if Pakatan Harapan does go into power, and that will be Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim. But who will be the seventh one if, you know, Pakatan Harapan actually wins GE14, right?
Okay.
I think that's a glaring omission right there.
Well, okay, so this is not when we form government. This is the structure of the coalition. And the way that Barisan Nasional is made up of different parties, and then Barisan Nasional itself is a coalition with a certain structure, right?
But they've gone to the extent of naming the eighth one, but not the seventh one.
Well, the person, of course, if Pakatan wins power at the federal level, then, and, you know, I think it was already very clear that certain hurdles would have to be crossed before Anwar Ibrahim could then take up the reins as Prime Minister. Because come GE14, chances are Anwar Ibrahim is still going to be in jail or unable to contest the elections. And so that something would have to be, a pardon would have to happen first. The pardon would have to go through. He would then have to contest the elections or a by-election, you know, get into parliament or be, you know, or I don't know if you can be in the Senate and become Prime Minister. But the point would be that there are several loops, and that's why there would always have to be, in some sense, an interim position, right? And so that interim position is where there's a huge question mark, right?
And there have been comments already that whoever this candidate for the seventh Prime Minister, you know, from the ranks of the opposition would be, you know, this individual will not be a seat warmer in anticipation of Dato' Sri Anwar perhaps being the eighth
Prime
Minister.
Yeah, I mean, the question, of course, also is that for ordinary Malaysians voters, I mean, are they as concerned about who becomes Prime Minister or are they more concerned with the policies of an incoming government and the question of how they will deal with all the bread and butter issues that Malaysians generally are focused on, including the question of the cost of living and such.
Excellent point.
And which is why I think the Pakatan Harapan has already come out to say that they will abolish the GST. And this might be part of their overall economic plan, but the point is that's also being addressed, not simply the question of who's going to be in that seat.
Yeah, certainly. And when it comes to policies, and I agree with you, I totally agree with you, you know, this the focus on policies should take front and center as opposed to the who, what, and how, right? But nevertheless, that plan to abolish GST has been described as economically nonsensical by certain economists. And I believe they've been quoted in Malaysia Kini and perhaps other media outlets as well, at least the link that I saw, that very attention-grabbing headline there, economically nonsensical.
I think that, you know, we go back to what the arguments made by the federal opposition in the lead-up to the implementation of the GST. Their concern was that the GST, as a means of collecting more money, is a danger for a government that does not practice fiscal discipline, that has not plugged leaks in budgets, that often goes to and creates supplementary budgets for which very little accountability. There's very little accountability. And I think and also hasn't been able to really balance operating versus, you know, development ratios in budget. So there's a lot of issues there.
Yeah.
But I see the point, you know, personally, of what the economist is saying. I mean, this is a country where the tax base was so small that, in fact, it was, not fair for, you know, just 10% or 15% of the population, working population, carrying the burden. And so there was and needs to be a corrective in line with, I think, global trends.
And it's also about improving your fiscal position, right, and diversifying your revenue streams, you know, because we have seen this shift in our over-reliance on revenue from energy-related resources, well, oil specifically, right? We have seen it, I think, about half now. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but we have seen that shift, and that is facilitated greatly in part by the GST as well. So being able to have more legs to stand on when it comes to your fiscal position, I think that's very important right there.
And the question is, at the end of the day, voters will have to make that choice. And if they are persuaded that GST should go now as a first step in terms of solving the cost of living pressures, then they'll be voting with those people. If not, and they're more persuaded by economists that the long-term interests of the economy are not served by removing the GST, then they'll be voting in other ways. So who knows? It's a question of the free debate, the free competition between ideas. Mm-hmm. Let's hope that's what our democracy stands for. We'll be back with more analysis after this. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.